for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Financial regulators filed fraud charges against Goldman Sachs last week. The SEC is reportedly looking for similar types of transactions in other Wall Street banks in the run-up to the Great Recession. The action could provide new impetus for the administration's effort to enact a massive overhaul of the U.S. financial regulations. Joining me to talk about the charges and the reform effort, Travis Plunkett, the Consumer Federation of America. Good morning, Travis.
Good morning.
And Peter Wallison, the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Diane.
And by phone from New York, Doug Elliott of the Brookings Institution. Hello, Doug. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
And, of course, throughout the hour, we'll welcome calls, questions, comments. Join us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Or you can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Peter Wallison, I wonder if you'd be good enough to explain to us first the charges against Goldman Sachs.
Yes, the SEC has charged Goldman with a violation of the securities laws because they assisted, according to the charges, they assisted Paulson, a financial company, the Paulson Group, to prepare a pool of mortgage-backed securities that is a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation pool. And according to the allegation, Paulson actually added various kinds of assets to that pool because it wanted to bet against the pool by buying a credit default swap. This is a very complicated transaction, obviously, for someone who doesn't follow this stuff. But when Goldman sold that pool, that CDO, to another party, actually a couple of parties, they did not tell those parties that the pool had been prepared by Paulson. So, and that Paulson was betting against the pool by buying a credit default swap. That would have been very material information for those people, and so that was the violation of the securities laws involved, because when you sell something, you have to disclose all material information about it. Over the weekend, there was a statement by Paulson that they had nothing to do with the preparation of this pool of securities. So that would be a major factual issue that would have to be resolved when this thing goes to trial,
so,
if it goes to trial.
Paulson says it's completely outside what Goldman Sachs did.
That's right.
Now, Doug Elliott, tell us who some of these clients were. I gather they were not only large institutions here in this country, but there were many in Europe.
Yeah, I don't have the list of who they were, but many of the European banks were buying significant amounts of these type of securities. In particular, there were state-owned banks in Germany that were rather desperately looking for yield from securities that seemed safe, and these were rated AAA securities for the most part. So they seemed to be safe, and they were paying significantly more than the other things they could have bought.
And
so, yes, so the Europeans are quite upset about this.
And, Doug, how strong a case do you think the SEC has?
I have no idea. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not. I don't know all the facts yet. We're going to learn a whole lot more as the discovery process goes on.
Travis, do you want to add to this?
The only thing I'll add is that it wasn't just the Germans. Apparently, the largest investor in this pool that Peter mentioned was the Royal Bank of Scotland, now owned by the English government. So the government of the United Kingdom is going to play a role here in terms of determining what it wants to do about the problems as well.
And now there are other U.S. Wall Street firms being investigated. Deutsche Bank, you've got UBS AG, you've got Merrill Lynch. This is really quite remarkable, Peter.
Well, yes, it is, if it extends as far as these reports are suggesting. We have to remember that in this particular case, there was a unique circumstance, and that is the idea that Paulson participated in the preparation of this pool. If they did not, there was nothing illegal about, at least as reported, there was nothing illegal about what Goldman had done, because presumably they disclosed all the material facts about the pool. The only thing the commission alleged was that they failed to tell the people who were buying that Paulson had been a factor in the preparation of the pool and had bet against it. That would be pretty significant information,
now,
if true.
Now, how strong a case do you believe the SEC has?
I don't think the case is particularly strong until we know more about Paulson's role. And if Paulson denies, as they did, any role here, I think this was more alarmist than anything else. But we'll have to wait and find out more details.
More alarmist than anything else, Travis?
Well, it's definitely a concern. I think the broader issue that has been raised regarding proprietary trading, it's called, the investment houses betting against some of the investments they were encouraging their clients to get involved with, is were they gaming the system? I mean, Peter's right. The material fact here is, was their disclosure of the role of Paulson, who was betting against this pool. But more broadly, we've got conflicts of interest in the investment arena that this legislation that's moving through Congress is designed to address, including the role of proprietary trading.
And Travis, on that note, there are lots of people who are saying that this case against Goldman Sachs could help move regulatory reform farther. Tell us what's in the bill at this point.
Well, we have legislation that passed the House in December and that is now moving to the Senate floor. Apparently, the Senate will start debate later this week on that legislation. And it's got a number of broad components, and there are differences between the bills, but both bills set up a new consumer regulator, consolidating consumer protection functions and setting up a regulator to watch out for abusive and deceptive practices in the marketplace that affect consumers. Both bills deal with the so-called shadow banking market, the sale of derivatives. This Goldman pool was a derivative product, a CDO, as Peter mentioned, which is largely unregulated. Both bills deal with systemic risk, that is, setting up a council of regulators to look at the overall risk that financial decisions by large firms have, the effect of that risk on the economy. Both bills deal with resolution. This is a term that basically involves what do you do when a very large, complicated multinational firm is about to fold. How do you deal with it? Do you deal with it the way the FDIC deals with failing banks? Do you step in? Do you try and wind down the firm so that when it does go under or when it is taken over by the government, it doesn't have this ripple effect on the economy that the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy had? And finally, both bills deal with investor protection. This is a little piece, but a very important piece. The House bill, for example, required a fiduciary duty. It required that broker-dealers that sell securities represent the best interest of their clients, sell them products that are in their best interest. That piece has been taken out of the Senate bill.
And isn't there also at least a proposal that large institutions contribute to a bailout fund of their own that would cover what would happen if a bank went down, Peter?
Yes, that is in the bill. There are two provisions in this bill. That is one of them that are the most worrisome, I think, to the Republicans and certainly to me. One is that all large non-bank financial institutions will be regulated by the Fed. The trouble with that provision is that we are in effect designating those institutions as too big to fail. The reason they are sent to the Fed for regulation is that there is some fear on the part of the people who are framing the framing the legislation that if those institutions fail, something will occur after they fail, like what occurred after Lehman. So the fact that we are designating them as systemically important institutions really makes them too big to fail. That changes the entire nature of our financial system in a way.
Well, how would you deal with it?
Well, let me just talk about the $50 billion fund, because
right.
That's part of this whole thing.
Sure.
And then we'll get to how or if I would deal with it. The $50 billion fund is set up in advance for the purpose of resolving one of those institutions if it fails. That also suggests what a problem this whole idea creates, because the important question here, Diane, is what do the creditors believe about these companies? If they believe that they will get a better deal if one of these companies fails than they will get in lending to a smaller company, then this gives all these big companies great advantages over smaller companies. It changes the whole competitive nature of our economy. Think about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Both of them were too big to fail. Both of them drove all competition out of their markets.
Peter Paulus, and he's with the American Enterprise Institute. When we come back, Travis Plunkett, I want to hear your view on that very provision. 800-433-8850. And we had some emails wanting to chime in on the conversation. Here's one from Louisa in State College, Pennsylvania. She says, isn't this similar to what the hedge fund Magnetar was doing at the same time? It was helping direct the construction of CDOs and then buying massive credit default swaps against them. ProPublica and This American Life did a story on this company last week. Magnetar made something like $6 billion from this. How much did Paulson make? Do we know how much Paulson made, Travis?
I actually haven't seen figures on that. I do know that in the scheme of things, this pool that Peter described was relatively small potatoes, not gigantic by Wall Street standards. But the broader issue, once again, conflicts of interest involving trading on Wall Street, it's important to point out that it's not just investors that ended up paying the price here, that this ultimately, these broad conflicts of interest have helped endanger the economy played a role in the problems we experienced 18 months ago because it wasn't clear what the role of these investment firms was, and we knew very little about overall about the derivatives market because it was largely unregulated.
Now, I want to turn to you, Doug Elliott, on this question of large financial institutions building a pool of money that would be available should one of these large institutions go down so that taxpayers would not be on the hook to bail them out. What's your view of that provision?
I think we need it. I believe what we need are tools to handle the situation where a very large non-bank financial institution, because we have good tools to deal with banks, but a large non-bank institution like Bear Stearns was or Lehman or AIG, if they run into trouble, the federal authorities have very little legal authority to deal with those situations now. And I think the lack of tools was part of what created the cost that we had. I think that while Peter is certainly right, we have to care about these issues of too big to fail, the fact is the market already knows that a number of these institutions are effectively too big to fail, that in a severe financial crisis, regulators and politicians are going to have a very hard time taking the chance on them actually failing. So I don't know that from a creditor's perspective, they're going to look at things that much differently if we simply don't set up a formal fund. If we do set up the tools and have a fund, we can at least deal with it more effectively, and we can make sure that the financial industry ends up paying, which is more doubtful if we try to assess them after the fact.
Peter.
The real question here is the certainty with which creditors will look at such a situation. If there is a fund, and I might say that Secretary Geithner opposed a fund set up in advance originally for good reasons, and that is once the fund is set up, it makes it much more likely it will be used. And to the extent that creditors look at this fund and they say, well, all these large companies are going to be bailed out. If I lend to those companies, I'm going to get a better deal when they fail than if I lend to a smaller company. So that will cause tremendous changes in the way our economy works. It will not be as competitive. This is a very troubling provision.
Travis.
The only thing I'll add is that in terms of the fund being used, it's really hard to imagine that any firm would manage itself into a position, into a process that ends with their shareholders being wiped out, the management being fired, and creditors collecting pennies on the dollar. I mean, there's plenty of market incentive for these firms to do the right thing and for creditors to account for that accordingly. And I'll just repeat what we just heard. We already have a situation where it is very clear that many firms are too big to fail. The question now is, how do we best manage that situation, which is not ideal?
All right. I want to, Travis, go back to one of the earlier provisions you talked about, that is that there would be a consumer protection organization within the Federal Reserve. Isn't there a fair amount of conflict over exactly that, not only the establishment thereof, but where it would be?
Yes, there's been some controversy. The House legislation that passed last year sets up an independent agency, and that's our preferred approach.
Why?
Well, we want to make sure that this agency has the independence and the authority and the power to make decisions to protect consumers. What we saw before was a situation where they really weren't independent. They were heavily influenced by the banks and other regulated financial institutions. Power to make decisions was fractured between seven different agencies. The idea here is we consolidate it into one agency. We give the agency the power to look at banks, to look at non-banks, to look at the whole market, to protect consumers from traps and tricks used by credit card companies.
But what about its location within the Fed or not?
Well, that's been controversial because of the Fed's shaky track record on consumer protection. They've gotten better in the last couple of years, but they overlooked huge problems in the subprime mortgage market, for example, failed to use authority they had since 1994. But I should add that the Senate bill gives the consumer regulator independence from the Fed. The Fed is actually prohibited from interfering with the consumer regulator's decision. It's that independence that is key to making sure that wise decisions are made for consumers.
Doug, I gather that you believe, for the most part, this is a good bill. Tell us why.
Yes, I do. For example, on the consumer protection that's being discussed, I do understand concerns about a new bureaucracy that might conceivably focus too much on the risk and not enough on the opportunity. But the problem is that having the consumer protection be run by the same people who also focus on the safety and soundness of the banking industry has led to situations in which consumer protection was made a second or third priority. And that worked out very badly, as we all saw in the last few years. So I think we have to take the chance of having an agency purely focused on the protection and give them enough independence to do a good job. But there is a danger that it will end up so focused on risk that it eliminates some things or sets up too much bureaucracy and does harm as well as good.
Now, President Obama is clearly taking a hands-on approach here. And do you, Peter, believe that this could run into the same kind of arguments back and forth as did the health care bill?
Yes, it already has, in fact. It's become very political. The president has charged the Republicans with caving into special interests and so forth, and the Republicans, I think, have united now in opposition to the bill, in part because of these charges that have been made against them. The fact is that the things I talked about before, having to do with too big to fail and bailouts, are things that make this bill one of the most troubling that we have seen. This is a dangerous bill, in my view.
And the Republicans
are opposing it on that ground. I think compromise is possible if the too big to fail kinds of issues were taken out. We can come to an agreement on a consumer financial protection agency of some kind. We can come to agreement on derivatives and things like that. But these other two provisions really have the potential, the too big to fail issues and the resolution issues have the potential to change the financial system, and the Republicans are quite worried about it.
Travis.
You know, Diane, Senator Bob Corker, who was an essential negotiator, a Republican from Tennessee, he negotiated on this issue of too big to fail. He has said that the problems that divide the two parties right now are actually quite small, and that the technical solutions could be decided in, quote, 5 minutes. So we have a typical situation here in Washington where, you know, significant but relatively modest differences have polarized the parties. And Americans are going to suffer if they can't get their act together and come up with solutions that are pretty apparent. The experts say that this division, this, you know, bailout versus no bailout division are being exaggerated, especially by those like Senator McConnell who claim that this is a bailout bill. He's working off, recommendations from a well-known pollster who basically said, if you want to stop Wall Street reform, blame it all on too big to fail.
Wait a minute, if I can just break in here. I have not read that pollster's work, and I agree with McConnell. This is a bill that creates too big to fail. As I suggested at the outset, once you regulate certain non-bank financial institutions because they are large and put them under the control of the Fed, you are saying they are too big to fail. How can McConnell be exaggerating when that's the exact effect that the thing would have?
Doug, Elliot, do you also see it as a bailout?
No, I don't. But I would agree with what Senator Corker was quoted as saying. I do think that while there are very legitimate issues such as Peter is bringing up, the bill has attempt to address that with some further compromise. I think there are ways of reaching something that, albeit reluctantly, some Republicans might support.
All right. We're going to open the phones now. 800-433-8850. First to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Diane. My question has been especially on the issue of too big to fail and the banks being so big that they pose a risk to the public good. Why have no antitrust measures been discussed as a possible solution? And I'll take my answer off there.
All right. Thanks for calling. Doug Elliott.
Yeah. First of all, I don't think we're at the point where it's an antitrust issue. That is, antitrust is when you have such a small group of institutions that they can collude with each other and have anti-competitive behavior. This is a separate issue. This is saying the financial sector is so big that if there are 10 players who are significant, they each in themselves may be so big as to present a danger. My view is that, unfortunately, we need at least a very small number of large banks that are truly global in scale, have a very wide range of products to support our businesses, and that have sufficient scale in each of those products to do it efficiently. I think the problem is when you add up what that means, you are going to have at least a small number of banks that are so big the politicians and the regulators won't be able to take a chance on them failing when we've got a severe financial crisis going on. So I think that if we were to simply deal with the problem by lopping them off and saying you can't be bigger than X billion dollars, well, there are two problems. One is I think we'd lose economic efficiency. The other is that wouldn't have helped that much in the crisis we just had. If you'd had 15 different Citigroups instead of one Citigroup, they all still would have made the same bet on mortgages. They all would have gotten into trouble.
Doug Elliott, he's with the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. My question is two-part. One, why is it not possible to regulate derivatives like we regulate stocks and have real effective oversight? The second part is, why is it impossible to, or a bad idea, to reinstate the legislation and regulation of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was repealed in the 90s and seemed to do a fairly good job for decades?
All right. Thanks for calling, Travis.
Well, I can start with the first question, which is regulating derivatives. A very important bill was released on Friday by Senator Lincoln from Arkansas. She's the chair of the Agriculture Committee, and she proposes exactly what the listener suggests, which is a central clearing process and an exchange process where it, in most cases, the trading of derivatives. And for those who aren't following the Wall Street lingo, a derivative is a financial instrument whose value depends on the value of something else, some other security. Such as a stock or a bond or the price of a commodity. And what she proposes is, in most cases, a clearing and an exchange process where you do know what the price is, where you can check the price out, where prices ostensibly would be more competitive, and there would be far more transparency in what's being traded and how much it costs.
Now, would that require yet another agency?
It would be regulated by the current set of agencies.
All right. And what about the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, Doug Elliott?
Unfortunately, it's not practical. Glass-Steagall worked in a period when the economy and the financial system was quite different. The main distinction of Glass-Steagall was that firms that made loans basically were regulated as banks. Firms that dealt with securities, which is when a company raises money by selling bonds or stock out to the market using an investment bank, the investment banks who dealt with securities were under a different set of rules.
Right.
The problem now is that securities and loans look very, very similar. Loans can be traded. They are generally not held by the original bank. And there are good economic reasons why we do have them spread out that way for diversification and other advantages. So I don't think we can go back to the old Glass-Steagall. You could conceivably take elements of that, such as Paul Volcker has suggested, I happen to disagree with his particular approach, but the best you could do is to take certain elements and continue those. The spirit of it, maybe, but the Glass-Steagall itself is quite outdated.
Peter.
Actually, there's a lot of misinformation about the Glass-Steagall issue, and I'd like to just address that for a moment. Glass-Steagall still applies to banks. Banks have not been removed from Glass-Steagall. They are not allowed, under Glass-Steagall, to engage in underwriting or dealing in securities. What was changed in 1999 was banks were allowed to affiliate with companies that were engaged in underwriting or dealing in securities. If we look at the current crisis, we can see that the banks got into trouble by making bad loans, which is what happens to banks very often, and the securities firms that got into trouble on their own. They weren't affiliated in any way with banks. These five large independent securities firms had no relationship at all with banks.
Peter Wallison. He is with the American Enterprise Institute. When we come back, more of your questions, comments. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Insomnia, snoring, apnea, and restless leg syndrome prevent millions of Americans from getting a good night's sleep. Why sleeping is so important to overall health, and advice from experts on how best to battle common sleep disorders. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. Here is an email from Robert. He says, one thing I believe is consistently overlooked in all the discussions is the effect of the financial misdealings of Wall Street on the retirement funds of the majority of Americans today. We've been weaned off pensions, placed into 401k retirement funds, in which we are mandated to participate in stock investments. Each time this sort of meltdown occurs, most of us find a lifetime of work and savings destroyed. What will happen to our country if down the road the majority of us are unable to live out our lives in comfort, while those at the top who profited by their schemes live like robber barons in opulence and extreme privilege? It does not sound like a rosy future for any of us if something meaningful is not done now. Travis.
You know, the New York Times this morning describes Goldman and J.P. Morgan and a few of the other investment houses as the mad scientists, of the housing boom, in that they put together these complicated derivatives packages. And derivatives reform is one of the keys to protecting, retirement savings. Who bought those investment pools? Who bought those investment vehicles? In many cases, it was institutional investors, pension funds. And so dealing with the derivatives market, making sure it's transparent and safe is a key in the future to protecting retirement savings.
Now, in terms of legislation that's been proposed now, would those retirement funds have been affected?
Well, they were affected, and they will be indirectly affected by the legislation, yes.
How so?
Well,
protected?
Well, by making sure that derivatives are essentially cleared so that it's not a deal between two parties sort of in the dark, and then traded on an exchange where possible, and having other protections in place, we assure that the derivatives are sold, you know, in the open and safely, and that there's adequate collateral behind them to make sure that the firms that are making these investments can afford them if they go bad. That protects the people who buy these products.
Peter.
The person who wrote the email, Robert, I think, is talking about two different things. Most people in their 401ks make stock market investments. And the stock market did fall substantially, but it's back about 70% this year. So if you kept your money in the stock market, it has come back almost to where it was. It's about 11,000 now. It was about 14,000 when things started to really go bad a couple of years ago. So the stock market has actually done quite well. The real problem that people are talking about here are these very complicated pools of securities that were sold, but they weren't sold to individuals. They can't be sold to individuals. They're sold to professionals, and they're sold very frequently to pension funds. And so the question is whether the pension funds understood what they were buying. The pools could be very valuable. In fact, all the losses that were suffered on Wall Street by Citibank and all the other institutions was because they held on to these securities, these pools of securities, believing that they had a lot of value. And many pension funds also bought these things, thinking they would have value and be safe securities, and it turned out not to be.
Do you want to weigh in?
Certainly. Look, the point that Robert raised is a very good one. All of us here on this show and most people in Washington on Wall Street want the system to be more stable. The financial reform legislation tries to do that in a lot of different ways. And we've been talking about the most controversial ones, but a lot of what's in there has broad agreement, including, for example, requiring that the financial institutions hold more capital as a protection against things that could go wrong, or that they have more cash and securities on hand that they could readily turn into cash so that there's not a kind of run on the bank. There are a lot of very basic, important things in the bill that we don't talk about because there's mostly agreement, and in some cases because the regulators will work out the details. But all of us want to make a more stable system so that the pension funds and others, the 401ks, don't suffer like this again.
Now, Doug, what about the prospects in the House and Senate, in the Congress? Do you believe there's going to be the kind of fight that there was over health care?
Well, I think we're having a version of the fight now, but I think it's a little bit of a phony war in the sense I think there's a whole lot more noise than there is actual disagreement. I agree with that statement of Senator Corker's that was quoted earlier. I'm hopeful that people will get past the politics on both sides and reach the compromise, get it through. I actually think they will, because unlike health care, the politics of this are very different.
How so?
The public really wants something to be done. This is very complicated, so they don't necessarily know what they want done, but they know something has to be done here. And that's a very different situation.
And can Republicans afford to be against most of the provisions?
I think that it's got to be a concern to them. If they feel strongly enough, obviously they will continue to oppose it. But there's certainly a considerable political price they would be risking And I think that gives more leverage to those who are pushing this through.
And the price would be because?
If the Republicans who oppose this, and it will be almost all Republicans that do oppose it, if they're perceived as being on the side of the bankers, that's a very bad political thing right now. And I'm speaking as a former banker myself. The public hates bankers with a passion. So that's, I think, what the main danger is.
All right, Maryland. Good morning, Larry. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Okay, I am now, every stock I've ever invested in has been manipulated. The first time I just happened to be on the right side of the trade, and right now, I am looking at a 427% profit on a very speculative trade for the current bubble. In the Gregory Zuckerman, the greatest trade ever, yes, that's right, John Paulson made $6 billion for himself and $20 billion for his firm. But what about Gregory Lippmann of Deutsche Bank and Jeffrey Green? Out in the Midwest, a lot of people saw this coming. All this talk about no one saw it coming, that's maybe what they tell themselves and what Chuck Prince tells Congress, but many people saw this coming.
Do you agree with that, Doug? Lots of people saw this coming. Doug, are you there?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I didn't catch you.
Yeah.
Look. Certainly, it's a big world. If you just count the number of people who saw this coming, there are quite a number. But as a percentage of the people who are involved in this, it was a low percentage. We'd had 25 good years in the financial markets. You know, we had some down periods, but mostly it's been a very good period. People got used to taking a lot of risk and having it worked out. And unfortunately, when you have enough years of that, people get lax, whether they're on Wall Street or they're regulating it or they're at the rating agencies, or homeowners who decided house prices couldn't go down. I think there was a universal laxity. Mm-hmm. But, of course, there are always some people who are smart enough to see through that.
You know, earlier we talked about this fund that perhaps banks will or institutions will be forced to create. How would that differ from the FDIC, which is currently in operation, which backs up each deposit at banks to a total of, what is it, $250,000 at this point?
Right.
Peter.
Well, it would differ substantially in the sense that no particular creditor is protected, as is true with the FDIC's protection of deposits up to $250,000. But from the standpoint of creditors in general, they would know that there is money to pay them off in the event that one of these institutions fails, and that, of course, is the central problem here.
Is the FDIC equipped to deal with a huge institutional failure?
No, my view is that they are not at all equipped for it. They handle mostly small banks. The largest institution that they have ever handled in any way was the failure recently of WaMu, one of the major banks. But they didn't
not
resolve it.
Not to be confused with WAMU.
Yes,
the radio
right.
Well,
that's Washington Mutual.
It's
exactly.
Washington Mutual.
Thank
but
you.
And WAMU, that WAMU will never fail. So we don't have to worry about that.
God's ears.
But from the standpoint of the FDIC, they just took WAMU over and sold it immediately to another large bank. So in effect, the way the FDIC operates is to make institutions that are already large, larger, because they don't actually resolve these institutions. They don't tear them down. They don't unwind them. They don't get rid of them. Mostly they just find a buyer for them.
Well, and the FDIC does not have huge resources at this point, Travis.
Well, I presume that it's anticipated that their resources will be increased if they're going to take on these new responsibilities. And Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, has said that they, you know, given their experience, there's no other agency within the federal government with the most experience, even though, as Peter mentions, these are smaller institutions. But they know the principles. They've done it with banks. She's made a strong case that they, with the resources, can do it with these substantially larger firms.
All right, to Otisville, Michigan. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I'm wondering, why do we allow these too-big-to-fail institutions to exist? It seems as though the risk they pose to individuals and U.S. economy is way greater than the value or purpose of their existence. Why not require them to downsize or divest when they reach a certain critical point?
Doug Elliott.
Well, as I was mentioning before, first of all, I do think there is substantial economic value from the scale and scope that they bring. But also, think back to the crisis we went through. Would we really have been in a very different situation if we chopped up all the big banks into 10 pieces? As I was saying, they all would have bet on mortgages. They all got involved in these crazy securitization instruments that got way too complex. All of the things we're concerned about were true for all of them. If we'd had to rescue 10 medium-sized ones instead of one big one, it would have been harder, probably.
Here's an email from Joseph. He's in Barnegat, New Jersey. How could a selected pool of bad mortgages still have a AAA rating? It seems many different organizations were involved with a massive deception while the regulators were asleep at the switch.
I think I can respond to that. If you take a pool of mortgages, even if they are subprime mortgages, they have a historic failure rate. Let's assume the failure rate is 10%. If the failure rate of these mortgages is 10%, then if 80% of the pool is rated AAA, it's very unlikely that any of the losses will ever reach that 80%, because the only losses will occur in that lower 10% category. And that's how you can take a pool of bad mortgages, subprime mortgages, and you can make a portion of that pool AAA.
Peter Wallace and the American Enterprise Institute. However, in that explanation, Peter, it would seem, and let me remind you, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, it would seem you're taking out the human responsibility there of individuals, individual organizations who were doing that kind of
they're just looking at
the failure. I mean, Peter's right on the theory, but in reality, the credit rating agencies had huge conflicts of interest and failed. In fact, it completely failed in many cases to call it right, to properly evaluate those pools and the risk that they represented.
And finally, to Marietta, Ohio. Good morning, Ruth. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
I'm listening to this conversation, and I feel like there's a segment of the population of which I represent that isn't included. We are people who've worked really hard, saved our money to try to retire without being dependent on our kids, and we are not getting any return on the money that we have saved. Our last statement from the bank showed our interest at 0.039. I mean, this, my husband's Social Security, I never worked. We have a large family. I stayed home and took care of the children. My husband's Social Security plus the little interest we're getting on the money we saved, it's negligible. And I know, I'm listening to you people who are talking about too big to fail and 401ks, but there's a segment of the population, maybe we're few, I don't know, that aren't being touched.
Ruth, I do not think you are among the few. I think you are among the many. And what you have said so eloquently represents the feelings of a great many people as we talk about these enormous institutions who have made such incredible profits for the people running them. Something has got to be done to create a more fair system. And Travis, you believe that this bill could help to begin that process.
We certainly do, and not for, you know, investors on Wall Street, but folks who only about half the country, you know, has any investment in the securities market. But for folks who buy homes and have savings accounts and need protection from abusive lending.
Travis Plunkett, he's with the Consumer Federation of America. Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute. Doug Elliott of the Brookings Institution. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.